Hello and welcome. This is the latest of the regular monthly updates from the board meetings of the International Accounting Standards Board. My name is Robert Bruce and I work as a financial journalist. With me to discuss the highlights of the January 2010 board meeting are board member Steve Cooper and the IASB's Director of Technical Activities, Helen Tashira. This month's turned into a real marathon. 6 hours Monday, 11 hours Tuesday, 10 hours Wednesday, 6 hours Thursday, over 30 hours of public meetings. And a lot of it in conjunction with FASB. How have you survived?
Well, it has been a tough week, Robert. This is the thing with having the FASB here. We take advantage of the fact that we've got them sitting in the same boardroom with us and going through a lot of our joint projects. There are differences we have between the way some of our board members think about issues and perhaps some of the FASB members think about issues. And it's only when you're sitting there that you can actually understand. One of the reasons we've got such a long meeting is that we have to be thorough in the way we discuss these things. We don't want to just push through decisions. We have to understand and what people are thinking and why there are differences there. Yep. And so if it takes 10.5 hours on a Tuesday, you know, starting at 8 and finishing nearly at 7 o'clock at night, that's what it takes to get it done. The other thing too is that we know it's a bit of a strain on people who are observing the meetings, but what we hope has been helpful too is that we've had a boardroom fit out, as people see, it's a much better experience, I think, and it's much easier to see what as people are talking, as our cameras move around throughout the meeting.
Good. Now, one of the overarching themes of the week has been disclosure, which affects a whole range of different topics. Steve, do you want to talk a bit around that?
Yes, thank you. The disclosure issues have come up in a number of areas this week. Revenue recognition, post-employment benefits, pensions, and financial statement presentation being just three of them. And disclosure issues are extremely important, but it's an area where the board does have difficulty because we get many people asking for more and more disclosure. There are certain items that they feel are missing from financial statements. So we get lots of requests, particularly from investors, to have increased disclosure. So there's always a tendency to throw everything in that anybody requests. So we had discussions, as I say, about what disclosure items should accompany our standard, the new exposure draft that we're going to put out on revenue recognition. Many people feel that the level of disclosure in that area perhaps is not as it should be at the moment. We also talked about post-employment benefits, and in fact the staff came up with an extremely long list of disclosures, and the message from the board was to go back and reconsider, because I think many of us felt that the list was somewhat excessive and burdensome. However, the difficulty is that when you ask people to look at each individual disclosure in isolation, there's always a number of people that are going to say, well, yes, I can see the need for that one, and it does look sensible. Pension disclosures focusing upon the breakdown of the item in the financial statements, the risks associated with those items, and you know, certainly pensions and many of the other topics we have are extremely complex, and to get a full understanding of the financial position of a company in respect of those does require quite extensive disclosures.
How do you stop it all becoming a vast telephone directory of...
Well, I think we have to be focused. I think we also have to do as much outreach as we can in these areas and gather views. And a good example of that is the direct method cash flow. Perhaps this is not quite so much a disclosure issue, but we have reconfirmed our position in the discussion paper that we should have a direct method cash flow statement, although we've now decided that we will have an indirect disclosure as well, so I guess that's increasing the amount of disclosure. But the direct method cash flow that we presented in the discussion paper was particularly lengthy and comprehensive and required perhaps an awful lot of additional work on the part of companies. So we're looking at how we can simplify that, and we've asked staff to go out and do some work to really identify what the costs are of different alternative presentation approaches.
It's interesting too. I don't think we do ourselves a service sometimes, but we have examples to illustrate the types of things we're looking for in our discussion papers, and we try to be comprehensive and so show all the sorts of things you might see in there. The chances of that happening for a typical company, you don't need to have all of those items there to paint a picture. And we're really trying to demonstrate the types of things that should go in there, but I think people get the message sometimes that they're because we had that in an illustration, they're required to put all those items in there. So we need to be more careful about the way we express things, and we're concerned, I guess, about the concept we have of materiality, is trying to explain to people that to paint a comprehensive picture doesn't mean going through a checklist of things. You know, and to Steve's point, I think we identified something like 76 items for disclosure in relation to pensions, and we know it's not what we intend to get to, but it's not helpful sometimes when people see that.
I think the issue of materiality is very important, because that's come up a lot recently. We don't mention materiality specifically in individual standards. We have it in IES1, and it's supposedly an overarching principle. But there has been a lot of discussion recently about whether we should say it in specific standards and give examples of where we think stuff might not be material.
Well, just to try and avoid other sort of reminder to people, back to the basic principles.
That's right. I mean, my personal experience, I feel that there have been situations where information has been disclosed that I would regard as not being material, but I think people do it just to be on the safe side.
Yes.
Which can be dangerous at times.
And it's difficult. And Steve said we're doing some outreach on that as well. We get mixed messages, because we can ask users and analysts what they actually want, and you'll end up, it's very easy to create this master list of wants, and it's a matter of then trying to identify what it is that they're trying to measure or what they need the information for, and then trying to get some sort of commonality across there. The other side of it is that people tell us direct cash flows probably is really expensive to prepare, and we hear the stories directly from the preparers that the companies are actually doing that. One thing we're going to do is go and talk to some of the software vendors, for example, because we need to get a good understanding of how their systems work and what extra steps would be required to get information.
Yeah. Let's move on in that case. Let's move on to financial instruments, which are everybody's fascination. We're talking about evolution now, Alan.
Yeah, it was a quieter meeting in terms of a lot of the financial instruments topics, because we've obviously, as you know, delivered IFRS 9, which has put in place the classification and measurement of financial assets. We've now got some work to do with liabilities, with hedging, and with the definition of equity, the liabilities equity split. So we've been working on all of those things, but perhaps not with as much outside, well, people from the outside world won't see as much intensity. So the main thing I think we're concerned about is at least giving outsiders the opportunity to see what the US model's going to be. The FASB is committed to producing their proposals by the end of March, and then people will be able to look at their proposals and contrast them with what we have in our model. And so we're aiming to get our hedging and liability material out towards the end of March, and that means that we will have, I think, all the pieces of the puzzle will be out there in terms of exposure drafts for impairment, hedging liabilities. So we'll have a period that people can look at our model, look at the US model, and then we can consider all of the comments we receive together with EPASB.
I think the hedging is very much work in progress. The staff here have done an enormous amount of work and a lot of outreach on that as well. And really the papers that were brought to the board this time were preliminary issues, particularly to do with the whole objective of hedge accounting. I think what we'd rather like to do is to move hedging away from a bunch of rules into something which has a bit more of a principle. And the staff brought forward two alternative objectives, principles. I think that the board actually liked aspects of both of them, sent the staff away to perhaps look at something that combined the two. But starting with that and then building from there, clearly there will have to be some rules in terms of restrictions and the like, but we would like those to be based around a sound principle. And we had a prim discussion about hedging of individual risks, and I know that's a particular interest to the non-financial institutions. Most people think of financial instruments being really the province of financial institutions, but hedge accounting certainly isn't. So we had an initial discussion on that, but there's a lot more to come in that area.
Yeah, and you mentioned devolution, Robert, too. Mm-hmm. I think that's probably best characterises the way we're looking at the definition of equity, because I think people have been a bit concerned that we're taking quite a radical approach to defining equity, equity liability split. But I think we're back to a much more evolutionary process now. I think we're heading towards, if anything, improving and simplifying IS 32, which is our standard, and creating a much simpler, cleaner model based on the principles.
Yeah, I mean, the difficulties always surrounded the options and the convertibles and these equity-linked instruments and what we should do with those. And it is very difficult. They have different characteristics, and trying to identify a way of fairly presenting these within the financial statements is not easy. But as Alan says, I think IS 32, for many people, you know, does a reasonably good job in many areas. So that's an avenue that we're particularly looking at.
Yeah, I agree.
Okay. Can we move on in that case to leasing and look at the simplification was in the air here, Steve?
Yeah, we took a number of decisions on leasing. I guess the two important ones were the concessions in terms of short-term leases and the other being investment properties. Clearly, the standard that we're going to bring out on leasing will affect many, many companies, particularly on the lessor side. And what we wanted to do was try and make sure that we don't unduly burden companies with the capitalization, recording assets and liabilities in respect of leases, where really that's not going to provide useful information, and force people to go down what could be fairly complex accounting in some cases. One idea is simply exclude short-term leases and use the current operating lease treatment for those. However, we decided that even short-term leases could be material. Obviously, the normal materiality criteria will apply, but there could be situations where a company has extensive short-term leases, but in aggregate, that becomes material. So what we decided on was a simplified approach, that we would ask for the recognition of an asset and a liability, but simplified to have no discounting, and simplified in the income statement to have just the rental expense presented. So this actually would use existing information that companies have, because companies already have to identify lease commitments for disclosure purposes. Mm-hmm. So it would involve really just rearranging the presentation of the information and no additional work. So it would be a considerable simplification, but at the same time, it would reflect on the balance sheet, the assets and liabilities that arise from material lease contracts. I guess the other, as I said, the other major decision was in respect of investment properties. We've done a lot of outreach on this, and many feel that IAS 40 works pretty well. They like the use of fair value for investment properties. Almost the whole of the investment property industry, at least in Europe, applies the fair value approach. I mean, there's only one listed company that doesn't, that we're aware of. It's clearly an area of difference, though, with the U.S. The U.S. doesn't require fair value for investment properties. I should say that under IAS 40, there's a choice, of course. It's fair value or cost. And then showing the rental income in the income statement. Applying the lessor model would require quite considerable change to that, and I think that the boards were not convinced that that would be an improvement. So what we've decided is to retain the current IAS 40 treatment for property companies, not apply the new model in that case, unless properties are measured at cost. If the cost option is used, then we would require the use of that new model. Interestingly, the FASB is, as a result of that IASB decision, the FASB is going to go back and consider an agenda decision for them to look at fair value for investment properties. I think the standard we have on investment properties works very, very well. I think most people are very happy with it, so I think that's an extremely good outcome.
Useful step. Consolidation.
Well, that's an interesting one.
Major changes.
Yeah, it is. The big changes, I think, potentially for the U.S., because their standard was written in 1951, so it's been around a wee while. And they're looking at changing it. For the very first time, we have this notion of being able to control less than half the voting interests. At the moment, they basically have a rule that say you have to hold more than half of the voting interests for what they call a voting interest entity, what we think of as normally an operating company, to be consolidated. And we've been developing principles in our exposure draft that basically give a very clear indication of when you can control without having majority of the voting rights. And the FASB has bought into that, and I think it was a unanimous vote actually for that concept.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. So that's a big change there.
Yep.
They've still got a lot of work to do. We've held back the project, as you know, to give the FASB a chance to consider what we've got. And the idea is that towards the end of March, again, the FASB ought to be putting out an exposure draft, which will look very similar to the exposure draft that we developed, or essentially what we would have thought of being as a final standard.
Good. Well, that rounds up virtually all the major things we wanted to discuss. What are other issues you want to wrap up with? And if you want to talk a little bit about what's coming up in the future as well.
I think one thing to mention, Alan, would be the netting issue. I think when we did the outreach on IFRS 9 and the other aspects of financial instruments, and also on derecognition, one of the things that we constantly heard, quite rightly, is that the netting of assets and liabilities, particularly netting of derivative positions in financial institutions, is dealt with very differently under IFRS and US GAAP. It's an important reconciling item. It produces quite different, well, scale of balance sheet, but also different equity ratios, leverage ratios. And many banks have said that we really should have a look at this, or both boards should look at it. And we have decided to do exactly that. We made no decisions about what potential changes there might be, but it's certainly an issue that we're well aware of, and that we are going to consider it as part of the derecognition project. It's not strictly derecognition, but that's where it most neatly fits in to our particular work program. So we will be considering that in a future meeting.
Yeah. The US has got more netting than we have, is that right, Steve?
The US has more netting than we have, so under IFRS there is a larger amount of assets, large amount of liabilities. It doesn't change net income and it doesn't change shareholders' equity, but it just changes the size of the balance sheet. And if you're calculating leverage by comparing gross assets with equity, then you get very different leverage ratios.
Yeah, see, I find the interesting thing here is that there are these common master netting agreements, the standard language that are used both in the US and across Europe and other countries. Mm. And yet, of course, we've got different accounting treatment potentially. So we're doing some more outreach, I think, with the derivatives industry to have a look at those agreements. And it just shows that the thing, you need to have common solutions to these things. Otherwise, you're getting very similar transactions reported in different ways.
Yeah, I mean, there are arguments for both netting in the way that US does and not netting the way that we do. Good arguments in both ways. And in a sense, both bits of information are relevant, but the balance sheet can only show one approach.
Yeah.
And we have to decide what's appropriate, and then if any additional disclosure is necessary to really give the full picture of what that additional disclosure should be.
And it would get rid of any particular confusion that the language just creates. So.
Yeah, yes, and I think another thing that it would help is from a regulatory perspective, you know, people that are using these financial statements not just to make investment decisions, but also to make regulatory decisions, trying to do that on a global basis is clearly difficult when you have quite different approaches to this whole netting issue.
What else is coming up?
Well, it's a quiet week here in London next week anyway, but that's because we've got some staff and board members away at a trustees meeting. That's going to be webcast, so anybody wants to listen to that, they can do so. And then we're coming straight back from the trustee meeting, and on the Tuesday the following week, that's the 2nd of February, we have a joint session with the FASB. It's about a 3.5-hour slot, and the agenda's just been posted up on our website for that.
And the financial statement presentation working group meeting, I think, that week as well.
12th of February, I recollect. It's and that's across in the US at FASB's headquarters in Norwalk. We've got three board members attending that, some staff, and another three, including Steve, participating here via London, because they've now got high quality equipment in their boardroom, and we can actually participate much more easily in any working group sessions we have there.
Exactly. Well, thank you very much indeed, Steve, and thank you, Alan. But before we go, finally, the traditional disclaimer. This podcast presents a non-authoritative overview of some of the major topics discussed during the board week in January. The views expressed are those of the individuals in this podcast and are not necessarily those of the ISB. Those of you who wish to go into the official detail of the board meeting should refer to the ISB update, which is published on the ISB website the week after the meeting. Thank you both.